enthusiasm was wilting swiftly this day. The afternoon was uncomfortably warm, with no sign of the ameliorating ocean breeze they call the Fremantle Doctor, because it makes you feel better, of course. I had already walked far enough to make my feet smoke when I realized that I still had a good 4 miles to go, nearly all of it along the busy, charmless, mercilessly shadeless Stirling Highway. By the time I flopped into central Fremantle, it was late afternoon, and I was comprehensively bushed. I went into a pub and downed a beer for medicinal purposes. "You all right?" said the barmaid. "Yeah," I replied. "Why?" "Seen your face." I knew at once. "Am I sunburned?" I asked bleakly. She gave a frank, sympathetic, but essentially deeply amused nod. I peered past her into the mirror behind the bar. Looking back at me, mockingly attired in clothes to match my own, was a cartoon character called Mr. Tomato Head. I allowed myself a small sigh. For the next 4 days, I would be a source of concern to every elderly Western Australian and of amusement to all else. Then, for 3 days more, as my skin flaked and peeled, and I took on the look of someone just escaped from a leprosarium, the mood would change to universal horror and revulsion. Waitresses would drop trays, gawkers would walk into lamp posts, ambulance drivers would slow as they passed and look me over carefully. It would, as always, be a quiet ordeal. In another 3 or 4 hours I would be in tender pain. Meanwhile, I was already a small wreck. My feet and legs hurt so much that I wasn't sure that they would ever be of service to me again. I was as dirty as a street urchin, and rank enough to be buried. And all of this so that I could see a house I had no actual interest in seeing, and then walk on to a place that I was now too tired to explore. But I hardly minded at all, and do you know why? I had seen a monotreme. Life could throw nothing at me that would diminish the thrill of that. Sustained by this thought, I drained my beer, lowered myself gingerly from the barstool, and limped through the staring crowds to see if I could find a taxi to take me back to the city. In the morning, I took custody of another rental car and set off on the penultimate of my Australian quests. I was on my way to the great Jarrah and Kerry forests of the Southwest Peninsula. If that sounds a trifle dull, then bear with me, please, for these are exceptional trees. They are to the Australian arboreal world what the giant worm of Gippsland is to invertebrates, large, underappreciated, and mysteriously occurring in only one small area, the southwest corner of Western Australia, below Perth. Kerries are Australia's sequoias. They attain heights of over 250 feet, but it is their amazing girth. They can be up to 50 feet around, and scarcely taper on their climb to their distant crowns, that gives them their majesty. Think of the mightiest, most graceful sycamore you have ever seen, then triple it in every dimension, and you have pretty well got a Kerry. The dominant species of the region, however, is the handsome and noble Jarrah, slightly less massive than the Kerry, but still enormous and arresting. It is something of a miracle that Jarrahs are left at all, for it is just about the unluckiest tree alive. The specialization that allowed it to flourish in the first place was also its tragic undoing, for Jarrah has the poor luck to thrive in soils rich in bauxite, and bauxite is a very valuable mineral. In the 1950s, mining companies discovered the connection and came almost simultaneously to the exhilarating realization that they could knock down and sell the Jarrah for quite a lot of money, then dig out all that gorgeously commercial bauxite underneath, thus getting 2 lots of income from 1 plot of land. Life doesn't get much better than that. So long, of course, as your conscience can bear the thought of removing large stands of prime forest of a type that occurs nowhere else and replacing them with large unsightly gashes. Mining engineers, these people are so ingenious, got around this problem by having no consciences at all. Brilliant. In this, they were long aided by their colleagues in the forestry industry. Australian foresters, it must be said, do rather like to chop down a tree. You can't entirely blame them. It is, after all, how they make their livelihood. And unquestionably, they are less reckless than in former times. But they were allowed to get away with so much for so long that they still need the most attentive watching. These are people, you must understand, who could describe clear-cutting as the full sunlight method of regeneration and not blotch. Just to ease you into a sense of perspective here, Australia is the least wooded continent, Antarctica excluded, of course, and yet it is also the world's largest exporter of wood chips. Now, I am no authority, and for all I know, this is all managed with the most exacting care. That is certainly the impression the Australian Department of Conservation and Land Management strives to create. But it does seem to me there is a certain mathematical discrepancy between having very few trees on the one hand and the world's liveliest chip exporting industry on the other. Anyway, there is much less Jarrah forest than there once was, and even a good deal less of the rare and clearly irreplaceable Kerry forests. According to William J. Lines, between 1976 and 1993, Australia lost a quarter of its Kerry forests to wood chipping. To wood chipping. I repeat, these people need watching. Even without its singular forests, the southwest corner of Australia would be an area of interest. Stretching for about 180 miles from Cape Naturaliste on the Indian Ocean to Cape Knob on the Southern Ocean, it is another of those unexpected intrusions of comparative lushness that occur in Australia from time to time. It's rather like the Barossa Valley of South Australia, but so obscure and unassuming that it doesn't even have a name. Nearly everywhere you go in Australia, you are provided with a handy label to fix your bearings. Sunshine Coast, Northern Tropics, Mornington Peninsula, Atherton Tablelands. But the zippiest appellation I saw for this region was the southern corner of Western Australia. I think they need to work on that a little. However, of the land itself and the seas beyond, no improvements are necessary. Perhaps it was because my Australian adventure was nearly at an end, and I was feeling consequently affectionate. Or maybe because I had spent so much of the previous couple of weeks at large in arid landscapes. Or perhaps simply because I knew almost nothing of the area. Hardly anyone outside Western Australia does, and thus had no expectations to disappoint, but I was charmed at once. It was as if it had been assembled from the most pleasant, least showy parts of Europe and North America. Lowland Scotland, the Meuse Valley of Belgium, Michigan's Upper Peninsula, Wisconsin's Dairyland, Shropshire or Herefordshire in England. Nice parts of the world, but nothing you would normally travel vast distances to savor. This wasn't a world-class landscape, but it was an engagingly snug and wholesome one. I dubbed it, and offer it here for free, pending the invention of something better, the Pleasant Peninsula, where everything is rather nice. So I spent an agreeable day, a pleasant day, motoring through woods and rolling fields, past orderly orchards and bottle-green vineyards, on winding country roads forever running down to a blue and sunny sea. It was a blessed little realm. I stopped often in the country towns, Donnybrook, Bridgetown, Busselton, Margaret River, to sit with a cup of coffee, or browse through stacks of second-hand books, or to take a walk along a wooden pier or dooney foreshore. I stayed the night in Manjimup, on the edge of the southern woodlands, and in the morning rose early and refreshed, and set off without delay in the direction of Shannon and Mount Franklin National Parks. Within minutes I was in cool green forest of erect and stately grandeur. This was very promising, indeed. I was headed for a place called the Valley of the Giants, to a recently developed tourist attraction that I had been told not to miss. It's called the Treetop Walk, and, as the name suggests, it's an elevated walkway that wanders through the canopy of a grove of tingle trees, yet another of the rare outsized species of eucalypts unique to the region. I had assumed it was essentially a gimmick, but in fact, I discovered that tingle trees, for all their immensity, are quite delicate and reliant on the few nutrients to be found in the soil at their bases, and that the constant trampling of visitors' feet was interfering with the breakdown of organic matter, imperiling their well-being. The treetop walk thus not only provided visitors with a novel diversion and an unusual perspective, but also kept them conveniently out of harm's way. The treetop walk stands a mile or two into coastal forest near the small town of Walpole. I arrived at opening time, but already the parking lot was crowded and filling fast. A lot of people were gathered by the entrance and milling around in the little shop. The whole thing is run by the Department of Conservation and Land Management, and, like the Desert Park at Alice Springs, was an impressive example of a government department doing something innovative and doing it extremely well. We could do with these people back in the known world. Well, all I can say is that the treetop walk deserves to be world famous. It consists of a series of cantilevered metal ramps, like industrial catwalks, wandering at exhilarating heights through the uppermost levels of some of the world's most beautiful and imposing trees. The treetop walk is an impressive erection. It runs for almost 2,000 feet, and at its highest point stands 120 feet above the ground. A goodly height, believe me, when you are peering over the edge of a waist-high railing. Since the walkway surface is an open grid that lets you look straight down, indeed more or less compels you to, there is a certain element of rakishness and daring in proceeding along it. I loved it. There are larger trees than the Tingle. Even the ashes of eastern Australia grow a little higher, and doubtless there are more beautiful trees than the Tingle. But I cannot believe that there are any trees in the world that are both. Redwoods may reach giddier heights, but their canopy is nothing, like a broom handle with nails hammered into it. Tingles, because they are broad-leaved, spread out with luxuriant profusion, makes all the difference. You simply won't find a better tree. I went around twice, charmed and appreciative. It wasn't until I was halfway around the second time that I realized that actually it was quite crowded, and that, like everyone else, I was sharing the experience with those around me, pointing out things to strangers, and in turn allowing them to point out things to me. I am seldom drawn to strange children, but I found myself now talking to two young boys, bright young brothers, about 10 and 12, on vacation from Melbourne with their parents, trying to decide between us whether there were koalas in Western Australia, and whether we might therefore spy any up here in the treetops. Then their father joined us, and we discussed it with him. Then the mother came along and took one look at me. "You know, you're awfully sunburnt," she said with concern, and offered me some cream from her bag. I declined, but was touched nonetheless. It was oddly heartwarming to realize that we were all having this experience together, sharing our observations and pharmaceutical products. It reminded me very much of my stroll through the parks of Adelaide on Australia Day, when hundreds of people seemed to be, effectively were, picnicking together. This had the same spirit of shared undertaking. In the most interesting and elemental anthropological sense, this was a social occasion. Even then, it didn't quite register with me how important a component this is in Australian life, until I descended to ground level and strolled through an area called the Ancient Empire. This consisted of a protective boardwalk path that made a large and inviting loop through another part of the same woods. It was, in its way, nearly as diverting as the treetop walk. To stand at the foot of a circle of tingle trees, head craned to take in their impossible remote heights, is an experience almost as dizzying as wandering on foot through the leafy canopy. But because the boardwalk wasn't novel and lofty, no one came here. I had it entirely to myself, but rather than feeling pleased to have found solitude, as I normally would, I felt suddenly quite lonely. "Hey, everybody," I wanted to call. "Come down and see this. It's great. Come down and be with me. Somebody, please?" But of course I said no such thing. Instead I had a long and respectful look around. It struck me in a moment's idle thinking that this forest was quite an apt metaphor for Australia. It was to the arboreal world what Charles Kingsford Smith was to aviation, or the Aborigines were to prehistory, unaccountably overlooked. It seemed amazing to me, in any case, that there could exist in this one confined area some of the rarest and mightiest broad-leaved trees on earth, forming a forest of consummate and singular beauty, and hardly anyone outside Australia has even heard of them. But that is the thing about Australia, of course, that it is packed with unappreciated wonders. And with that thought in mind, I set off now for what was, in its quiet way, one of the most amazing wonders of all. Chapter 19. Earlier on this trip, while driving back to Sydney from Surfer's Paradise, I stopped for coffee in a pleasant college town called Armidale, in northeastern New South Wales. Indulging myself in a brief amble through its attractive streets, I happened on an official-looking building called the Mineral Resources Administration, and, I don't know why exactly, I went in. I had long wondered why there is such an abundance of mineral wealth in Australia, and not, say, in my backyard, and I went in thinking maybe somebody could tell me. One of the delights of poking about journalistically in a cheerful and open society like Australia's is that you can just turn up in places like the Mineral Resources Administration with nothing very particular in mind, and people will invite you in and answer any questions you care to put to them. The upshot is that I spent a half hour with an obliging geologist named Harvey Henley, who told me that, in fact, Australia is not really fantastically over-endowed with mineral resources, at least not on the basis of mineral wealth per square meter. It's just that Australia has a lot of square meters, relatively few people, and a short history, so that much of the country is still unexplored and unexamined. To put matters in perspective for me, he took me through to his work area to show me what he does for a living. He makes geological maps, large, impressively detailed ones, rolled like blueprints, which he spread across the table with a certain respectful care, as if they were old prints. Even an untrained eye could see that they recorded every lump and ruffle on the landscape, with particular emphasis on pools of mineralogical splendor. Each, he explained, covered a portion of New South Wales 60 kilometers long by 40 wide, and took 10 to 15 man-years to produce. The Armidale team was in the process of surveying 80 such blocks. "Big job," I said, impressed. "You bet, but we're finding new stuff all the time." He drew back one map to expose the one beneath. "That," he said, tapping a portion of the map shaded in a restful pastel tone, "is a new mine at a place called Caddis Hill, near Orange. It contains about 200 million tons of mineral-bearing sands." "And that's good, is it?" "That's very good." "So," I said thoughtfully, trying to get a grasp on all this, "if it takes 10 to 15 man-years to produce one map covering a block of land 60 kilometers by 40, and if there are 8 million square kilometers in Australia, then how much of the country has been properly surveyed?" He looked at me as if I had asked a very basic question. "Oh, hardly any." I found this quite an arresting thought. "Really?" I said.
"Sure."
"So," I went on, still thoughtful, "if you parachuted me into some random spot in the outback, into the Strzelecki Desert or something, I would be landing on a patch of land that had never been surveyed."
"Formally surveyed?"
"Almost certainly." I gave a moment to taking this aboard. "So just how much mineral wealth might be left out there to be discovered?" He looked at me with the happy beam of a man whose work will never be completed. "No one knows," he said. "Impossible to say." Now hold that thought just for a moment while I take you with me to the lonely coastal highway from Perth north to Darwin, 4,163 kilometers away. Here, near the coast, there are a very few towns and quite a lot of visible farming. But head inland over the low pale green hills to the right, and with amazing swiftness you will find yourself in a murderous and confusing emptiness. And nobody really knows what is out there. I find that a terribly exciting thought. Even now, people still sometimes make the sort of stupefying, effortless finds that can only happen in uncharted country. Just recently, some beaming fellow had come in from the western deserts, cradling a solid gold nugget weighing 60 pounds. It was nearly the largest such nugget ever found, and it was just lying in the desert. Goodness. Mining experts may study satellite images and the sort of charts generated by repeated airplane passes at low altitudes. Fantasy maps, as Harvey Henley termed them for me, just a touch dismissively. But up-close investigations, the kind that involve wandering through dried riverbeds and taking rocks away for later analysis, have barely begun. The problem lies not just in the vastness of Australia, though that is daunting enough, goodness knows, but in the risks involved in wandering into unknown country. As the British paleontologist Richard Forty has written, tracks appear briefly, only to disappear into ambiguous washes, where the bewildered and anxious passenger is instructed to hang out the window to look for broken twigs which might indicate where a vehicle has passed before. It is appallingly easy to get lost. In such an environment, rumors of fabulous, unexploited finds naturally proliferate. The most famous story concerns a man named Harold Bell Lassiter, who in the 1920s claimed to have stumbled on a gold reef some 10 miles long in the central deserts 30 years before, but for various reasons beyond his control, had neglected to return to claim it. Although it seems an unlikely tale, the story evidently had greater plausibility than a bare description would suggest. In any case, Lassiter managed to persuade several skeptical businessmen, and even some large corporations, General Motors for one, to underwrite an expedition, which set off from Alice Springs in 1930. After several weeks of confused and fruitless tramping around, Lassiter's backers began to lose confidence. One by one, his team members abandoned him, until Lassiter was on his own. One night, his two camels bolted. Lost and on foot, he died a lonely and wretched death. I dare say he drank some urine. In any case, he never found the gold. People are searching for it yet. Although Lassiter was almost certainly either sorely deluded or a charlatan, the idea of there being a vast reef of gold just sitting in the desert is not at all beyond the bounds of reasonable possibility. Nor is it as implausible as it seems that people might make such a fabulous find and then, as it were, mislay it. Others, far more meticulous and attentive than Lassiter, have misplaced important discoveries in the desert. Such was the case of Stan Aramick, a geologist who was poking about in the low, irregular, exceedingly hot hills of the Pilbara, a region of northwestern Australia still largely unexplored, when he came upon an outcrop of rocks bearing tiny fossilized organisms called stromatolites, dating back to the dawn of life some 3.5 billion years ago. At the time of Aramick's discovery, they were the most ancient fossils yet found on Earth. From a scientific point of view, these rocks were the equivalent of Lassiter's elusive gold reef. Aramick collected some samples and made his way back to civilization. But when he returned to the Pilbara to pursue his searches, he couldn't find the rock outcrop again. It had just vanished into an endless sameness of low hills. Somewhere out there, those original stromatolites still wait to be rediscovered. It could as easily have been gold. Since that time, other stromatolite beds of similar or greater venerability have been found elsewhere, both in Australia and farther afield. Meanwhile, however, in the warm, shallow waters of Shark Bay, on a lonely stretch of the Western Australian coast, scientists found something no less extraordinary and even more unexpected. They found a community of living stromatolites, colonies of lichen-like formations that quietly but perfectly replicate the conditions that existed on Earth when life was in its very infancy. It was this that I was on my way to see. It's about an 8-hour drive from Perth north to Shark Bay. In the early afternoon, near a place called Dongara, the road curved down toward the sea, and I began at last to get glimpses of blue ocean. This section of Western Australia is called the Batavia Coast, which, as it happens, was something else I was interested to look into. At Geraldton, the only town worthy of the name, certainly the only place with more than one set of traffic lights, for 600 miles, I stopped for coffee and parked by chance outside a small maritime museum in the town center. I hesitated by the door, torn between the need to keep moving and a curiosity to see what was in there, then impulsively stepped in, and how glad I was I did, for the museum was devoted in large part to the little-known story of the ship that gave the coast its name, a forgotten merchant vessel called the Batavia, which blundered onto Australian shores in 1629, and in so doing set in motion one of the most bizarre and unlikely episodes in the annals of maritime affairs. Most Australian histories give it no more than a footnote. Manning Clark does not mention it at all, which is a little surprising because it was the first sojourn by Europeans on Australian soil, and it remains the greatest slaughter of white people in Australian history. But I get ahead of myself. In 1629, when our story begins, Dutch mariners had only recently discovered that the swiftest way to the East Indies from Europe was not to make a beeline across the Indian Ocean after rounding Africa's Cape of Good Hope, but to drop down to the 40th parallel, the famous Roaring Forties, and let those lively winds convey you eastward. The approach worked well, so long, of course, as you managed not to crash into Australia. Alas, this was the fate that befell Captain Francisco Pelzert, 2 hours before dawn in early June 1629, when the Batavia ran aground on some sandy impediments called the Abrolhos Islands off Australia's west coast. Almost at once, the ship began to break up. Many of the 360 people aboard drowned in the confusion, but 200 or so managed to struggle ashore. As the sun came up, they found themselves on a desolate sandbar, with a few salvaged provisions and exceedingly dim prospects. They were 1,500 miles from Batavia, now called Jakarta. Pelzert ruminated for a while, then announced that he would take a party of men in a longboat and try to row to the distant Indies, a faint hope, but their only one. He left in charge a man named Euronymous Cornelis. What happened next is not entirely certain, but it appears that Cornelis was both a madman and a religious fanatic, always a dangerous combination. What is certain is that over the next few days, he and a few faithful followers slaughtered the bulk of the survivors, 125 men, women, and children in all. The few they spared became their slaves, the women to cook and provide sexual favors, the men to fish and work. Except for a small group who escaped to another sandbar a couple of hundred yards away, across a difficult channel. There they made such weapons as they could fashion from shells and driftwood, and built a fort to stave off the attacks that Cornelis and his men occasionally flung at them. Pelzert, unaware of the turmoil he had left behind, and with quite a lot on his mind already, he had, after all, wrecked a brand new ship, the pride of the Dutch merchant fleet, rowed on to the Timor Sea, and miraculously reached Batavia. There, his dumbfounded superiors listened to his tale, gave him another ship, and ordered him to return at once for survivors. 5 months after all his troubles started, Pelzert arrived back at the Abrolhos Islands. There, the ever-blundering captain, finding the survivors engaged in the civil war, came within a whisker of supporting the wrong side and losing his ship to the crazed Cornelis and his desperate band. Eventually, however, he managed to sort out what had happened and to introduce order and justice to the murderous little sandbar. Cornelis and 6 henchmen were swiftly hanged. Most of the others were whipped or keel-hauled and clapped in chains to be taken back to Batavia for further corrective treatment. But for reasons unknown, Pelzert decided to go to the considerable trouble of having 2 of the miscreants, a marine named Wouter Loos and a cabin boy named Jan Pelgrim, rowed to the mainland and marooned there. On November 16th, 1629, they were set down at a place called Red Bluff Beach. What became of the 2 Dutchmen after that, no one knows, but 2 things are certain. They were the remotest Europeans in the world, and the first white Australians. Red Bluff Beach, I learned from the helpful museum staff, is at a place called Kalbarri, a couple of hours farther up the coast, and, since it was on the way to Shark Bay, I decided to stop there for the night. Kalbarri lies about 40 miles down a side road, off the northwest coastal highway, across a green plain covered to every horizon in heathery scrub. It was getting on for evening when I arrived, too late to go looking for the Dutchman's landing place, so I got a room in a motel near the beach and contented myself with a stroll around the town. Kalbarri was an appealing little place. It dates only from 1952, when some fishermen discovered that the waters offshore teemed with lobster. Until the mid-1970s, when the road in from the Northwest Coastal Highway was paved, it was essentially cut off from the outside world, except by sea. Today, fishing remains at the heart of community life, but it has also grown into a small resort. The two seem to coexist very well. The setting could hardly be bettered. It stands on a big bay, sheltered by long white sandbars. I walked to the front through warm end-of-day sunshine. The Abrolhos Islands were 60 kilometers out to sea, well out of sight of the mainland, but I could clearly see, only a couple of miles down the coast, the headland called Red Bluff, where the 2 mutineers were marooned. As I strolled along the front, 2 things caught my notice. That a few hundred yards out in the bay, a boat, half-sunk, was being towed very slowly into the harbor through a narrow channel between the sandbars, and that crowds of people were gathering to have a look. The biggest cluster of onlookers was on the jetty at what appeared to be the commercial side of the harbor, about a mile away. Here on the resort side of the harbor, there were lots of people, too, sitting on the hoods of cars parked along the beach, gazing from the balconies of seafront homes and apartment houses, coming out of shops and pubs to stand and watch. About it all, there was a strange, almost eerie silence. I asked a man sitting on a car what was going on. "Oh, it's a fishing boat that got hold on a reef last night," he explained. The accident had happened at 2:30 in the morning, far out to sea, and for a time it looked as if the boat might be in serious peril. To add to the tension, the skipper had his 7-year-old son with him, evidently taken out with him as a treat. 3 other local fishing boats had gone out to rescue them. I looked at my watch. They'd have been at it for 16 hours by now. I remarked on this to my informant, and he gave a small smile, as if in apology. "It's been a long day for the town," he said. "We've been on a bit of a knife edge. Still, it seems to have turned out all right." Kalbarri has a year-round population of 1,500, and I would guess that 2/3 of the town was there. As the boat came through the sandbars and its safety seemed assured at last, people from all sides of the harbor clapped warmly, as if welcoming home the winner of a regatta, and called encouragement. I thought that was wonderful, that a whole town would turn out to watch a stricken local fishing boat brought in. If I handed out fivers, I'm sure I couldn't find 1,000 people to watch me limp into port after a night of peril. I decided I liked Kalbarri very much. In the morning I rose early and drove the couple of miles along the coast to Red Bluff Beach, where I had been told I would find a cairn marking the spot where the 2 naughty Dutchmen had been left to their lonely fate. It was a dramatic spot, a very large rock platform bashed by waves, which threw spray everywhere. Leading off to one side was a long, duny beach, marked at intervals with signs saying, "Caution, dangerous rips." The ocean was a bright turquoise, and the long beach was being pounded by a fury of big waves. I had a good hunt around the area, but couldn't find the cairn anywhere, and there was no one out at this hour to ask, except for a couple way down the beach exercising a bouncy dog. It hardly mattered. Whoever built the cairn had to have done so long after the fact, and was almost certainly guessing. So I just enjoyed the sunshine and sea-freshened air, and realized with a touch of surprise that the idea of being stranded here wasn't entirely without appeal. It was a lovely spot. The sea was lavishly fruitful, and the hills behind abounded in materials for building. Luz and Pelgrim, again for mysterious reasons, were quite generously endowed by Pelzer. They were left with a small boat, some food and water, a few tools, and some trinkets with which to trade with the natives, if any could be found. There were certainly far worse places in the world to spend out your days, not least a fetid and malarial dungeon in Batavia, which was their alternative fate. Assuming cordial relations with the natives, you could make quite a nice life for yourself here. I was quite taken with the notion, not least because it was so patently a real possibility here. The coastline of Western Australia north from Perth is astoundingly beautiful and almost entirely untouched by development. Beyond Kalbarri, there is not a single town for some 200 miles to Carnarvon, and just one side road to the sea, the one I was heading for at Shark Bay. Beyond Carnarvon, it's much the same for another 1,800 miles to Darwin, just a coastline of undisturbed splendor, dotted at distant intervals with small communities. Altogether, Western Australia has some 7,800 miles of coastline, and only about 36 coastal communities, even including those along the southwestern peninsula from which I had just come. That is, of course, why it took so long to discover the stromatolites at Shark Bay. Though they are there on the edge of an accessible shell beach, for any fool to see, they weren't noticed by anyone until 1954, and not identified by science for another decade. But then, with almost 23,000 miles of Australian coastline to investigate, it takes time to get to it all. From Kalbarri, it was 40 miles back to the Northwest Coastal Highway. There is still just the one road in and out, and then another 100 or so miles onto Shark Bay. In 2.5 hours, I passed just 3 other cars and a solitary barreling road train. At one point I saw a couple of mysterious dots in the road far ahead, It turned out to be two workmen, digging a hole in the middle of the highway and protected from either direction by a single orange plastic cone placed in the center of the road about 5 feet from where they were digging. This was, you understand, the main West Coast highway. It was an arresting reminder of just how far from anywhere I was. This was about as far from the main population centers as you can get in Australia. By road from where I was now, it was over 4,000 kilometers to Sydney, and nearer 5,000 to Brisbane. Even Alice Springs, the nearest town to the east, was 4,000 highway kilometers away because of the way the roads ran. At length, in the middle of a featureless nowhere, I came to the turnoff for Shark Bay. I followed a newly paved side road for a few miles to another unpaved side road, which passed through a marshy landscape for another mile or so. It ended at an old telegraph repeater station at a place called Hamelin Pool, a complex of white wooden buildings, one of which now announced itself as a museum, another as a cafe and gift shop. The parking lot had only two or three other cars in it, but as I stood reading an information board, two buses pulled up in convoy, wheezed to a pneumatic halt, and almost at once began disembarking streams of passengers, all white-haired, camera-toting, and blinking confusedly under the impossible glare of sun. They appeared to be from all over, America, Britain, Holland, Scandinavia. Having come this far, I didn't wish to share the experience with 100 twittering strangers, and I set off in a brisk stroll for the beach along a chalky track. It was amazingly hot. A breeze was running in from the sea, but it seemed only to bring more heat. After about half a mile, the track brought me to a sumptuously sunny bay, flat, calm, and of the deepest aquamarine. At some distance across the water, a long sandbar ran in a lazy curve out to sea. This, I gathered, was the Foray Sill, a 30-mile-long dune barrier that nearly encloses the bay and gives it its special character, namely warm, shallow, very saline waters of the sort that once prevailed across the planet when stromatolites were king. Nowhere in any direction was there a sign of human intrusion, except directly ahead, where a nifty wooden walkway zigzagged for 150 feet or so out into the bay over some low, dark, primeval-looking masses that didn't quite break the water's calm surface. I had found my living stromatolites. Eagerly I boarded the walkway and followed it out to the first cluster of shapes. The water was as transparent as glass and only 3 or 4 feet deep. Stromatolites are so primitive of nature that they don't even adopt regular shapes. They just sort of, as it were, blob out. Nearer the shore, they formed large, slightly undulant platforms, rather like very old, poorly laid asphalt. Farther out, they were arrayed as individual clumps that brought to mind very large cow pies, or perhaps the dung of a particularly troubled elephant. Most books refer to them as club-shaped or cauliflower-shaped, or even columnar. In fact, they are shapeless gray blobs, without character or luster. It has to be immediately conceded that a stromatolite formation is not a handsome or striking sight. I can almost guarantee that your reaction upon seeing a bed of living stromatolites for the first time will be to say, in the vague, ruminative, cautiously favorable tone you would use if you were given a canapé that tasted better than it looked, but not so good that you wanted another right away, or possibly ever. It is a sound that says, well, I'll be. So it's not the sight of stromatolites that makes them exciting, it's the idea of them, and in this respect, they are peerless. Well, imagine it. You are looking at living rocks, quietly functioning replicas of the very first organic structures ever to appear on Earth. You are experiencing the world as it was 3.5 billion years ago, more than 3/4 of the way back to the moment of terrestrial creation. Now, if that is not an exciting thought, I don't know what is. As the aforementioned paleontologist Richard Forty has put it, this is truly time-traveling, and if the world were attuned to its real wonders, this sight would be as well known as the pyramids of Giza. Quite right. Stromatolites are rather like corals, in that all their life is on the surface, and that most of what you are looking at is the dead mass of earlier generations. If you peer, you can sometimes see tiny bubbles of oxygen rising in streams from the formations. This is the stromatolite's only trick, and it isn't much, but it is what made life as we know it possible. The bubbles are produced by primitive alga-like microorganisms called cyanobacteria, which live on the surface of the rocks, about 3 billion of them to the square yard, to save you counting, each of them capturing a molecule of carbon dioxide and a tiny bead of energy from the sun, and combining them to fuel its unimaginably modest ambitions to exist, to live. The byproduct of this very simple process is the faintest puff of oxygen. But get enough stromatolites respiring away over a long enough period, and you can change the world. For 2 billion years, this is all the life there was on Earth. But in that time, the stromatolites raised the oxygen level in the atmosphere to 20%, enough to allow the development of other, more complex life forms. Me, for instance. My gratitude was real. The chemical process involved in this makes the little cells very slightly sticky. Tiny motes of dust and other sediments cling to their surfaces, and these slowly bind and accrete into the rocks I was looking at now. The stromatolites thrive here not so much because the conditions are particularly amenable to them, as because they are discouraging to other creatures. The reason that stromatolites don't exist elsewhere is that they would be either washed away by stronger tides or eaten. Here nothing else can survive the bitter salt waters, so there is nothing to graze the stromatolites away. That stromatolites gave rise to life on Earth, then became a food themselves and were eaten out of existence, has a certain irony, of course. Something not entirely unlike that happened to me now, for as I stood peering into the crystalline waters, the elderly day-trippers could be heard coming down the track, and a few minutes later the spryer among them began to arrive on the boardwalk. A woman in a Miami Dolphins eyeshade took a position beside me, stared at the water for some moments, waved away a couple of flies, then regarded her husband, and in a voice that would have drowned the clang of a steelwork, said, "Are you telling me we just crossed a continent for this?" I was feeling charitably disposed, so I turned to her with an understanding smile, and with all the gentleness and tact I could muster, I endeavored to ease her into a position of appreciation for this marvel that lay at our feet. I saluted her perceptiveness in recognizing that stromatolites were not much to behold, but explained how their diligent, infinitesimal chemical twitchings over a span of unimaginable duration made the world the green and lovely place it is. I pointed out, too, that at only 2 other places on Earth have such living formations been found, one elsewhere in Australia, the other off a remote coral cay in the Bahamas, both much smaller and practically inaccessible, so that this was the only place in the world where visitors could, with relative ease, examine these singular creations in their full, understated glory. So in fact, I concluded, and here I offered my warmest, most ingratiating smile, this really was worth crossing a continent for. She listened with what I can only call an air of startled submissiveness, never taking her gaze from my face. Then she touched a hand to my forearm and said, "Did you know that you have the most terrible sunburn?" I took a walk along the neighboring shell beach until the flies made it impossible to persevere, then wandered back to the telegraph station. The museum was locked and in darkness, so I went to the cafe. The trippers, I gathered, had stopped for refreshments, because the woman in charge was busy rounding up cups and plates. I wondered in passing how she managed to feed coachloads of people 140 miles from the nearest supermarket. "Yes, love," she said brightly as she passed. "I was wondering if it's possible to see the museum." "Course it is. I'll get Mike to take you." Mike was Mike Cantrell, an equally cheery middle-aged fellow with a raffish earring and an easygoing manner, who emerged from the kitchen wiping his hands on a tea towel and looking pleased to be excused dishwashing duty. He took me to the museum and with some difficulty unlocked the door. The museum was small and airless and felt as if it hadn't been opened for months. He told me that not many visitors asked to see it, but entirely charming. One room was devoted mostly to stromatolites. It had a fish tank with a stromatolite quietly bubbling away in it, the only one in the world in captivity, apparently. On an old TV and VCR, he showed me a 4-minute video, which gave a brief but concise rundown on what stromatolites were and how they were formed. Then he picked up a brick-sized fragment of old stromatolite and passed it to me, and I made the appropriate expressions of surprise at how heavy it was. The rest of the museum was given over to its days as a telecommunications outpost, first for telegraphy, then for telephones. It was a great deal more appealing than I had expected it to be, not least because one of the walls was dominated by a large photograph of a linesman, Adjie Cross by name, standing at the top of a ladder, buck-naked, repairing a telegraph line and looking for all the world as if this were absolutely the correct attire for telegraph repairs in the outback. He was naked, Mike told me, because he had just swum the Murchison River with his ladder and didn't want to get his clothes wet. I didn't say anything, but the thought crossed my mind that wet clothes would dry out in minutes in the desert, whereas boots, the one thing he had kept on, would stay wet for hours. My suspicion is that Adjie Cross did his line repairs naked because he liked to. To which I say, why not? I also learned the happy story of Mrs. Lillian O'Donohue, who was a telephone operator here in the days before automated telephone exchanges. At Carnarvon, up the road, was a big satellite dish that NASA used until the 1970s to track spacecraft as they passed over the Indian Ocean. During a mission in 1964, the communications link between the Carnarvon dish and a tracking station near Adelaide broke down, and all messages had to be routed through Mrs. O'Donohue and her ancient equipment. Through one long, hot night, Mrs. O'Donohue sat at her switchboard, carefully recording strings of coded messages from one outpost and passing them on to the other. Each time the Gemini craft passed over southern skies, the fate of the mission, I just love this, was in the devoted hands of an unassuming little old lady sitting in a small white building miles down a dusty track on the West Australian coast. She made $6 in overtime money, Mike told me. I loved that, too. When we emerged and Mike had locked the door, we walked together across the parking lot. I asked him how he had come to be in this lonely place. He told me that he and his wife Val, the cheery woman behind the counter, had been there for just 3 weeks. They were novice gray nomads, retirees, often these days early retirees, who sell up, buy a motorhome of some description, and spend their lives on the open road, stopping from time to time to earn a little money, but never tied to anywhere, and essentially ever on the move. 6 months earlier, this would have seemed to me the dreariest punishment imaginable, endlessly driving across a landscape that is mostly hot and dry and empty. But now I understood completely. All that emptiness and white light has a seductive quality that you might actually never tire of. An amazing thought. Besides, Australia is just so full of surprises. There is always something just down the road. A treetop walk, a beach harboring ancient life forms, museums celebrating improbable Dutch shipwrecks or naked telegraph repairmen, really nice people like Mike and Val Cantrell, a fishing village turning out to see a stricken ship limp home. You never know what it's going to be, but it's nearly always pretty good. Maybe it was just my mood at the time, but I felt I could keep this up for a good long while yet. So I thanked Mike for showing me around and returned to my glinting vehicle. Even from a distance, I could see it was going to be unbearably hot inside, so I opened the doors to air it a little and went with my book of maps to the shade of a bent tree beside the track to the beach. I don't know why I bothered exactly, because the only way back to Perth was the way I had come, along the long and empty Northwest Coastal Highway. But as I stood there, I flipped idly through the other pages of Western Australia. It's so big it needs several, and my eye was caught by a patch of highlighted landscape very near the Northern Territory border. It was a range of hills called, with unimprovable melody, the Bungle Bungles. I'd only lately read about these. The Bungle Bungles are an isolated sandstone massif where eons of harsh dry winds have carved the landscape into weird shapes. Spindly pinnacles, acres of plump domes, wave walls. The whole extends to about 1,000 square miles, yet, according to the book Australia, A Continent Revealed, these extraordinary formations were not generally known until the 1980s. Think of it. One of the natural wonders of the world, covering an area the size of an English county, was unvisited and essentially unknown until less than 20 years ago. I had a sudden powerful impulse to go there. When would I be this close again? Besides, it would be a chance to drive into the Pilbara and visit Little Marble Bar, famous as the hottest town in Australia. I could see the landscape where Stan Oremic found and lost his fossilized stromatolites. From there it was but a hop along the Victoria Highway to Darwin. The wet season would be over soon, so I could go to Kakadu National Park, said to be a wonder, but a virtual lake when I had been in the area, and maybe even cross Queensland to visit Cooktown at last. Why, I could do this forever. But of course this was just a fantasy, born of perhaps a little too much sun, a natural longing not to have to retrace my steps along 450 miles of lonely highway back to Perth, and a genuine reluctance to bring this adventure to a close just yet. I made calipers of my fingers to measure the distance, and was both appalled and hardly surprised at all to find that it was 1,600 miles to the turnoff for the Bungle Bungles, plus another 100 miles or so over rough backcountry tracks on which I was neither insured nor safe. Here I was, halfway up the West Australian coast, on the very edge of the world, and there were still 1,600 miles of emptiness to an attraction in the same state. What a preposterously outsized country this was. But that is, of course, the thing about Australia, that there is such a lot to find in it, but such a lot of it to find it in. You could never see the half of it. Idly I wondered what my wife would say if I called home and announced, "Honey, we're selling the house and buying an Australian motorhome. We're off to see the Bungle Bungles." I didn't think it would fly, frankly, so I shut the car doors, climbed into the driver's seat, and began the long journey back to Perth. I drove in the gloomy frame of mind that overtakes me at the end of every big trip. In another day or two I would be back in New Hampshire, and all these experiences would march off, as in a Disney film, to the dusty attic of my brain, and try to find space for themselves amid all the ridiculous accumulated clutter of half a century's disordered living. Before long I would be thinking, "Now what was the name of that place where I saw the big lobster?" Then, "Didn't I go to Tasmania? Are you quite sure? Let me see the book." Then finally, "The Prime Minister of Australia? No, sorry, no idea." It seemed a particularly melancholy notion to me that life would go on in Australia, and I would hear almost nothing of it. I would never know who ended up with the Hancock millions. I would never learn if anyone found out what became of that poor American couple stranded on the Great Barrier Reef. Chinese immigrants might wade ashore and ask for cabs, and I would never hear of it. Crocodiles would attack, bushfires would rage, ministers would depart in shame, amazing things would be found in the desert, and possibly lost again, and word of none of this would reach my ears. Life in Australia would go on, and I would hear nothing. Because once you leave Australia, Australia ceases to be. What a strange, sad thought that is. I can understand it, of course. Australia is mostly empty and a long way away. Its population is small, and its role in the world consequently peripheral. It doesn't have coups, recklessly overfish, arm disagreeable despots, grow coca in provocative quantities, or throw its weight around in a brash and unseemly manner. It is stable and peaceful and good. It doesn't need watching, and so we don't. But I will tell you this, the loss is entirely ours. You see, Australia is an interesting place. It truly is. And that really is all I'm saying. This is Bill Bryson. We hope that you have enjoyed this production of In a Sunburned Country. This program was produced by John Wager and directed by Eleanor Branch. Production copyright 2000, Random House Incorporated. All rights reserved. The book, In a Sunburned Country, is available wherever Broadway books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.